Welcome everyone to For the Sake of Search, your local search podcast, local to wherever you are. Today I'm here with Nikolai from Icebox Data Solutions, and this is your first time joining us. Welcome. We're glad to have you. We hope you keep coming back. And today we're going to be talking about why you shouldn't fine-tune, which honestly, this was such a hot take for me because I've heard so many people give the advice, you need to be fine-tuning to get good results. So with that, Nikolai, could you talk a little bit about who you are and who Icebox Data Solutions is?
Yes, big question. Who am I?
Who are you?
So I'm Nikolai. I started, like, when I got into AI, I started actually with LLMs or with transformers, and they weren't called LLMs back in the day. Yeah. So I got my start with them, and I started especially with GPT-2 and also BERT. And back then, you actually had to fine-tune to get anything useful out of them. And this is how I got my start, like mostly doing LLM work for different companies, freelancing and stuff like that. And after that, with a few buddies of mine, we started our own consultancy in the end. We're specializing on AI implementations, focusing mostly on VLMs, LLMs, which is my specialty, or going into like the financial or biomedical domain.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Also, it's funny you mentioned like back in the day with BERT. I mean, I think a lot of people don't realize just how long language models have been around and like generally available. Like, what was it? BERT was available in like, was it 2011, I think?
No, BERT is 2018.
Oh, okay. BERT is 2018. There was one more that predated it, but I'm not going to worry about which that was. But yeah, no, I think you're right. The landscape has changed so much over the last couple of years, and it's become so much more accessible. What was that like getting started? You know, like how did you actually start? Was there like a thing, a place?
I got pulled in through a buddy of mine who was really deep in like the NLP space, and he got inspired, I think, like Niels Reimers, who like most search people probably will know. He was following him a lot, and he is like one of the godfathers in the end, I think, of like embeddings. And through that, he found like embeddings for NLP, and then I got into it, and then we just started hacking around. And after GPT-3 came out, we had a hackathon with OpenAI. So that was in 2020 or 2021. I'm not entirely certain anymore. And there I really realized like how much stuff will be possible with these models. They weren't great out of the box, but they could do like so much stuff just in natural language, and like the out of the box performance you got from them already was really impressive. But they like they had massive consistency issues back then.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting. Well, and I think a lot of our understanding of language models has like had to change, and very rapidly. I mean, it's funny, you were just talking about like 2021 as if it was like a decade ago, which it feels like a decade ago as far as like how far we've come in the last couple of years.
I think it's because the pace of the field, it's so fast, and it's like we got used to like a weekly, bi-weekly cadence of launches that it's so hard to keep up that it feels like it's forever when the field first got started.
Yeah, which is it's interesting, you know, and I think a lot of that comes back to like there were like a handful of breakthroughs that happened, you know, back in, you know, 2021. With like multi-head attention, all of these different architectures, which is really neat. But so let's get into a little bit like why shouldn't people be fine-tuning now? That like this is kind of a hot take. A lot of companies are investing a lot of money into fine-tuning. So let's start with what is your impression on fine-tuning, and like how would you define fine-tuning for people?
So it's a hot take, especially because I earn a bunch of my money through fine tuning. and I think like you should not fine tune unless you have specific reasons to do it. Mm. Nowadays, because the performance is so good out of the box, you can get a lot out of existing models just through prompting. So fine-tuning actually has a lot of downsides. Mm-hmm. It will lead you down a certain path which you have to stick with. And this is for one that you have to actually keep up to date with new model launches. So every time a new model comes out, you actually have the FOMO. You have to try whether you can squeeze the extra performance out of it. And this forces you like to consistently train the model on your data set, keep the data set up to date. And this just basically to keep up with the state of the art of the field. And yeah. the iteration cycles get longer. Because a training run, especially if when you're using larger models, like yeah. beyond 70 billion, they take a while if you have a large data set. And when you instead lose like closed source providers, like the iteration cycles is really short. You just change the prompt and that's it. And I think fine-tuning, you should do it when you really have good reasons to do it. Like, for example, you can't get the required performance out of the closed source providers. Mm. Also, privacy is a good reason, especially here in Europe, where this is actually why we are doing like most of the fine tunes, is because we have privacy reasons where they can't really let the data even out of their own servers. So you have to use something custom, also something more efficient because you don't have the compute infrastructure.
Yeah, the efficiency is a huge one. And you're talking about model performance. Are you talking just there about like generation speed or like the precision of the models? Like what does model performance mean in this context?
So for me, model performance is always task specific. And these are like the more ML performance criteria, like latency, time to first token, which is something that popped up recently. And on the other hand, it's like the, in the end, task performance. Like usually you use the model for a specific task and you want to evaluate that model on that specific task. And that is rather what I'm talking about. When you actually don't get a powerful model like 4.0 or even 0.1 mini or 0.1 preview by OpenAI or also Claude, when you don't get that to perform well on your task, I would give fine-tuning a shot, but it also probably means you have to decompose the task because it's just too complex.
That's really interesting. And I think this is the other thing that a lot of people don't realize is if you have a very hard time like fine-tuning your prompts, you're probably going to have an even harder time fine-tuning your model because I feel like that comes back to, you know, you have a data problem. You need to understand what your users are trying to do, understand the outputs they want, and building that like evaluation framework, I feel like actually might be one of the hardest parts because I think fine-tuning is getting to the point where it's fairly, I don't want to say easy, straightforward maybe, like it's starting to be very well documented. Do you feel like that's a fair assumption?
I think fine-tuning has gotten really easy. So the actual act of fine-tuning something, just basically I have a data set and fine-tune a model, it has become so easy with all the providers like OpenPipe, for example, also Replicate, that it's not difficult anymore. Even like if you train a very large model and you have to distribute it, they basically take all of that away. And in most cases, I would recommend companies to just use a provider because you don't want to deal with all the MLOps issue of distributed training.
Yeah. But again, it comes back to, do you actually know what people are trying to get out of it? And also, you mentioned some of the like specificity, like how, like, are most companies dealing with very specific use cases, or are they trying to handle very like broad sweeping, I want a generic model that can handle all of my use cases? What do you see people doing right now?
So what companies want is like a generic model which can handle all of it. In the end, when we especially look also at the history of AI, it's you can handle most tasks you want to do best when you use specific models, and often like compound systems where you actually use a combination of different AIs for specific subsections or subtasks of your tasks. And really try to break it down and pick something for that broken down component that's really suited for it. So if you're doing a classification, I wouldn't reach for an LLM. I would use something more suited, and especially something smaller, because it's way more efficient. And in the end, also in LLMs, people have gotten used to not thinking about the data, because you can feed anything in and you get good results in most cases. But I think once you scale it up, most people realize it doesn't work as well, because you can reach a good accuracy, but the accuracy is capped. So you can't get it to like 95, 97% accuracy in most cases. And this is something where you actually then need the task-specific models to squeeze the extra percentage points of performance out of there, which you need for like deployments in a corporate environment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think like you talked about the accuracy of the data, and that sits really home with me, because, you know, in search solutions, it's almost always a challenge of like, how can I get the most precise results without missing the right results? And I think a lot of people are like just jumping in and saying, hey, my like language model can like figure that out for me. But that's true and also not true. You know, you need to make sure that you're feeding these models the right and most accurate data, especially I'm talking about specifically like a RAG scenario, which for those who don't know is retrieval augmented generation. And, you know, that process, it's interesting because everyone reaches for AI. They're like, oh, we need an embedding model. We need, you know, this, we need that. But there's kind of a lack of appreciation for the search as a domain there. Which actually, that kind of feeds into this question. Like, how many, like, do you see a lot of people that with like search expertise that are also building these, you know, language model systems, or are they just like only interested in the LLMs?
But it's, I think Doug Turnbull is trying to start a counter movement to RAG with generative AI augmented retrieval. And I think LLMs, they have become a replacement of actually doing the AI work and the grunt work. Because, to be honest, no one likes labeling data sets and looking up the data, cleaning up the documents in your search database. Mm. And I think LLMs are so good that they can handle a lot of garbage. But then you cap their performance by like a few percentage points, because it would be better if you would actually spend the time cleaning up the data and creating good data sets. And also you can save a lot of money by just using simpler and smaller models.
Yeah, exactly. And, oh, go ahead.
Yeah. And I think like if you think of LLMs rather as a tool, you can do a lot of good with them in a search context. Because they allow you to do a lot of stuff. And I think especially in an offline setting, like preparing the data sets, looking for inconsistencies, classifying different documents, just finding, for example, also ambiguities. Like if you're running a RAG, you often see that you have, even in like company documentations, you have documents that actually aren't consistent but say opposite things. And I think LLMs in places like that can do a lot of good.
Yeah, and actually I think what you just mentioned is one of the areas I feel like a lot of people are starting to recognize LLMs are super helpful, because even in my own line of work, like one of the hardest challenges is getting internal people to make judgments on data sets. And like, I need a data set full of like searches and document pairs that someone has judged and said, these are a good match or these are not a good match. And, you know, doing it with people is really hard, but if you can get just a handful, then you can start to do things like, I'm going to say RAG judgments. That's terrible. But kind of that idea of like, hey, look, here, your language model, here's a sample query. This is a sample document. This is how a person rated it. Now go and rate this document with this new document and this new query with that context.
Yeah, and especially like speeding up the groundwork, like just having an LLM label your entire data set and then having a human correct. Because often editing or correction is easier to do than actually just doing the labeling entirely on your own. And I think for that, LLMs like are a great addition. But yeah, they're not a replacement of like all the relevance and search work you should be doing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think that's the thing, is it's an augmentation, not a replacement, which I think a lot of companies, much to my dismay and probably yours as well, think that, you know, LLMs are just going to come in and replace large swaths of their workforce. Talking about you, Dell. But anyhow, they just were called out recently for replacing large parts of their support staff with LLM agents. And I just, that makes me so nervous. I think it can maybe help in some cases. Hopefully they've done their research and they know what they're doing. But it's one of those places that makes me nervous, you know?
Yeah. And I think like when I try to introduce AI to a company, and I think like Dell, I think might be like ahead of a lot of companies out there.
Probably.
But yeah, the you usually don't just replace entire people or even entire workflows. You start with something really specific that at the moment takes a lot of time, wastes a lot of resources, and likely also the people don't really want to do, like data labeling. Yeah. Start with something like that, and you're likely to see like way better adoption of the tools. And also people can get used to AI, and then you can introduce AI gradually and take over more of the work. And also figuring out how to solve a problem when the problem is smaller is way easier than if you take like an entire process, what usually takes multiple people.
Yeah, actually, it's almost like, what is that called? Doing like performance optimization, like flame graph analysis on, you know, like on your person workflows, you know, like figuring out, hey, which part of this person workflow takes the longest and is the most, you know, time consuming, error prone. You can look at it a lot of different ways and figuring out, hey, can I take some of the burden off of that one task to free that person up to do more valuable work?
Yeah. And I think like a lot of people don't think like developers. I think like as developers, you're like rather on the other side. You try to automate too much in the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think the like trying to automate stuff, if more people in the entire enterprise would think like that, it would be easier to find good use cases. And I think that's what also like a lot of companies are actually struggling with. And that's how you end up with like the standard stuff like chatbot on the website. Hey, we are generating marketing texts. We are generating white papers. We are generating like our social media texts, which is just something.
It's so funny. It's a solution in search of a problem.
Yeah.
You know, and I think actually that I've heard that over and over again, you know, a lot of people are predicting that in, you know, a year or two, we're going to see a bunch of companies dropping in Gen AI because they simply couldn't get the ROI because they didn't start with a problem that they needed a solution for. They started with a solution.
And over-investing in the process.
Yeah, over-investing. Which actually, I mean, that's a fair point. You talk about also why not fine-tune, and that is one of the biggest things, is they haven't even tested to make sure their theories are workable, you know? And that's where you can get a lot out of prompt engineering. Just working on that, you know, you can build a really generic solution, and then you can start to find out like, hey, maybe this isn't enough still.
And also like, if you don't really understand the problem you're trying to solve, and you also don't understand the problem in a way that you actually can quantify how well you solved it within AI, so you don't have any evals, how could you even think about fine-tuning? Because you won't have any chance assessing whether the model performs better than anything else you have going on currently.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that is also like such a broad and challenging space that most people just don't even know exists. Like the evaluations is, it's really important, you know, and I see this in the search space all the time. People, you know, they'll have these really big, large, you know, search templates and they're like tuning and boosting. They're like, maybe this made this a little better. Or, you know, I've even seen people make like sweeping changes. Like one person recently that I saw took the value of a field and just like floored it so that it was almost not contributing to anything. And it was to solve like a single problem that they had, a single problem query. And I'm like, okay, so like if we do that, we're going to pump the brakes for a second. You will affect every single other search that we do not have tests for. And it's hard. It's hard to think like that, but you do have to think as like a big picture. So what, talking about evals, I mean, I'm actually really not familiar with like the evaluation space as it relates to language models. Like what are people using? Like, are there like certain frameworks that are being picked up a lot, or what have you seen?
I think there are a bunch of companies coming in who are doing that stuff. One of them, Human Loop, I think is one. Brain Trust is another one. It's, I to be honest, I don't like to use any closed source providers. And there is, for example, also OPIC, which you can use by Komi, which is open source, but you can self-host. And the evaluations, in the end, you can just write them on your own. They aren't difficult. I think you have like three different options. The first one is using LLMs as a judge. How is it called? So basically, you're asking the LLM how good an output is. And then you basically use like a binary, like good or bad. You use like a scoring rubric from 1 to 10, which is something that's uncertain. Because LLMs also have biases, especially when it comes to numbers because of their tokenization. So some numbers are just way more likely to be predicted than others. So I like to stay away from scores. A last one is, which is something I often do, is using basically like multi-class classification. And I tend to do like A, B, C, D. Like basically you have an exam to solve. And this is on a side note. It's something I really had a lot of success with is stealing scoring rubrics of teachers.
Really?
And especially when it comes to writing tasks, I like to steal stuff from teachers, which is out there, because they often have like a good evaluation frameworks and definitions of the different scores, which is very well articulated. What makes like a really good, good, bad, mediocre result. And I just steal it as a definition and basically use it as a multi-class classification and restrict the model to just output one token, so A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and basically monitor also the output tokens it has. So when you look at an LLMs, you usually get like what tokens are in the mix are considered because it outputs a distribution. So I can actually track like what tokens did it put out. And basically when it's very uncertain, I can basically also consider that in how likely the score is.
Wow. That's actually really interesting. And I mean, I think that kind of like, especially limiting it to a much smaller range. Like I don't like 1 through 10 type evaluations, like you said, because you end up like getting a lot of the same type of number. And that's why I always like kind of like NDCG, you know, is a lot of times people do it on like a 1 to 4 scale, which I think, and also like translate it into actual meanings, like good match, somewhat match, poor match, not a match at all. Which I think is helpful. But
my pet peeve with that always was like, what is a good match? Yeah. I think that's like a little bit of a pet peeve of mine because it's really use case specific. So I think like search people should define it better in to make it like good match really specific for the use case or for the type of search that's actually being run.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I can speak to this working at GitHub. That's really challenging because I'll tell you, they're like, this was one of the things that I had an idea about coming into GitHub, but like didn't really know. People use our search for the weirdest stuff. Like what is it, dorking, which is one that I played with a little bit before coming to GitHub. But dorking is this idea of like, hey, we're using your search and we're going to basically try and find if someone's accidentally exposed a secret through a bad pattern. And dorking is this like art of creating a search that looks for like a, I don't know, I don't want to call it like a hash, but like a fingerprint that says, hey, you know, this person probably put a secret in their code. I actually have a good example for myself, which I didn't actually check this in, but I had at one point a Docker definition that I was creating, and I was like, oh, cool, this like Docker file accepts a file path. That is, the file path is the pointer to the file that contains the secret. Turns out my understanding of it was incorrect, and what became the secret was the file path itself, and that is something someone could have searched for and found the password to my website database, which thankfully I did not check that in. It is not in my production, but still, it was one of those things that, you know, like you talk about use cases that people have, it is really, really hard to represent those well. Which actually, I mean, do you see a lot of people doing personalization when it comes to LLMs? And what does that look like? Is that just prompt engineering? Are people actually building personalization? What is it, like tokenizers that go alongside language models? What do you see out there in space?
So no, I think like there are a few companies only in the world who are touching tokenizers. I think for the rest of us, we don't really touch them anymore. No. We take them as given. When it comes to personalization, it's like the easiest way is just prompt engineering.
Yeah.
But there is a limit to which you can push it because of the instruction fine tuning that has been done. Do you want me to go a little bit into the different types of training that's done?
Yeah, that would be perfect.
So basically, when you look at the entire training process, you have like the pre-training, where you just use like the entire internet, basically, and a lot of other documents, like you use code, basically everything that's on GitHub. You use also documents you find. And you basically just do next word prediction. So you take a passage of text, you block everything so the model doesn't see it that comes after like the first word, and then you just iteratively predict based on the previous tokens. Mm-hmm. And this is basically your pre-training. And you do that on trillions of tokens. And then after that, you have instruction fine-tuning, which is basically you have question answer pairs or just some form of instruction by the user and some form of answer by the model. And this instruction fine tuning is basically making the model better at following directions. And this is what wasn't there in GPT-3 and what made it really challenging to get something good out of it. But also, it's, in my opinion, you get way more expressiveness in like the not instruction fine tuned models. Because they don't really have these like the restriction on specific types of answers. Because what these models are used for and what training data is available for like the instruction fine-tuning, it's like more biased towards like a general population and not specific tasks. And that's how you end up with like this standard LinkedIn type of vocabulary and style of writing. Then you just tell it, like, write me a post about X, like a lot of emojis, like the standard vocabulary, a lot of Delph. And you usually have a lot of success when you take the pre-trained models and actually when you have a good fine-tuning data set that you actually use the pre-trained model as opposed to the instruction fine-tuned model for your fine-tuning. Because it makes more of a blend and lets you more personalize the model in the end to the specific task at hand. Because otherwise, you basically remove the training that has been done with the instruction fine-tuning. But also, you need a lot more data because you actually need to train in this instruction following the general capabilities as well. And this would be like the highest degree of personalization with an LLM you can do. Now you have like a third way, which is like long context windows that you can't just give it a lot of examples, a lot of few shots, basically, which have also input-output pairs, and just give it a lot of them, which basically bias it towards certain tokens, which should mirror the stuff you've already given it.
Yeah. Yeah. But the challenge there is then you start running into, much longer generation times. Because I feel like from what I've seen, it feels like generation time is exponentially related to the amount of input tokens. Do you feel that's like a kind of a fair assumption, or like I know models have gotten better, I've noticed, but at the same time there is a limit. At some point it becomes too restrictive.
So if you have the case where basically the long context always stays the same, you can cache that stuff. So this is also offered by Claude, this is offered by OpenAI. I think it's offered by OpenAI, I'm not entirely certain. It's offered by Google as well. And you can cache them, and so you don't really have the computation cost. And this basically means the tokens are just stored, and also the attention weights between the different tokens are also stored. So you need to compute less. But you still, in comparison to like having a shorter input, you still need to compute a lot, because you have 100,000 tokens which you're comparing to the input you're feeding in, as opposed to 10,000 or 5,000.
Yeah, absolutely. We've talked a lot about different types of like applications for language models, and you mentioned like tasks specifically. So I want to get kind of your take. I mean, do you feel like a lot of people are starting to work with language model agents, and how much attention do you feel like is there right now?
Way too much. It's, I think agents, it lost a lot of its value as a term, because it's used so freely.
Yeah.
And when I think about agents, is I give it flexibility in planning of what actually to execute. The model comes up with a plan, and then it basically orchestrates the different steps to different workers. That's what an agent is to me.
Yeah, yeah.
I think like as it's used in the space, it's like using a combination of different technologies, like an LLM with a RAG, and the LLM can freely choose whether to call like a tool, like for example, search, or execute an action, that already counts as an agent, which I wouldn't really count as an agent. Like, it has some stuff it can do, but for me, like, an agent would have to execute it way more freely. And
interesting,
I have tried like this free agent stuff, which is also something like the Cody, for example, the coding agent is supposed to be doing and stuff like that. I think you have a lot of issues with reliability and also predictability, because I want to know like how well will it perform on a specific task when I'm using it in the corporate environment, and also how reliably is it doing it. And when it comes to executing actions in the real world, or if it's just doing basically tasks for me in my corporation, like data entry and stuff like that, I want to know like how reliable is it. And I think this is a large issue at the moment. Even like achieving a high reliability is very difficult when you use LLMs. And when you have like a chain of LLM calls, it will become like exponentially more difficult.
Worse. Yeah. No, I get that actually, because so it's funny, I did when agents first started coming out, I started working on a project, because like one of my biggest challenges I always feel like is I run into this challenge. One of my biggest challenges is a challenge that I often need data sets for work that I want to do, and building data sets is really time consuming. It's tedious. So I was like, maybe I could take a language model agent system, and like you said, give it access to very specific tools and have it, work on this problem and build me a really nice structured data set. And it was so funny, because my language model got very distracted. In one case, I was trying to build a data set for like creating houseplants care. I was like, create this data set, you know, pick some popular houseplants, find their care, create a standard, you know, data model for them and like find the care for that. So the idea was, you know, it's going to find some common houseplants. It's going to say, hey, these are the things people need to worry about for houseplants, and then go find those pieces for each of the houseplants. And that's how I thought it would work. Turns out it became obsessed with finding the top houseplants, and it just generated a ton of work finding the like top, best, most common houseplants, and it never moved on from that. And it was so frustrating. And I think that's another thing that a lot of people like lose in the agent thing is it comes back to evaluations. At what point is a task complete? How do you tell it? Like, you know, and you can artificially restrict it. You can say, hey, like if you get more than five, what is that called? Five agent calls deep, then you've gone too far. Don't find more than 100 houseplants. But, you know, but like you said, it's missing that flexibility. We want it to be able to just go and execute the task. I don't want to say autonomously because I feel like that's overused, but kind of along those lines.
Yeah. And I think like for the foreseeable future, at least, you're always better off you just breaking down a workflow and figuring out a way to do it in a combination of AI and just plain old software.
Yeah.
And the tasks that I would give an LLM to execute like freely are probably so invaluable that you don't really want to execute them in the first place or build a solution for that.
Yeah.
Because I think you want to spend a lot of computation where it's actually worth it. And the places where it actually matters, like LLM aren't there yet, or like agents aren't there yet to actually do that. So you have to be really specific, break down the problem, and use LLMs for subsets of these problems where they are really suited for. And they have a lot of value for specific tasks, which other models just can't handle. But giving like everything to the LLM also is the wrong choice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And actually, I mean, like if I went back and rebuilt that project, the part that I would go and change is specifically, I would have it go and determine, like I can figure out like top 100, top 1000 houseplants. I can, you know, you can do like token binning or whatever and just create, what is that called? Like a histogram of all the houseplants in Google searches. But the really valuable part there would be like, coming back to that categorization problem, like, hey, you know, here are like 10 houseplant like care guides for this one plant. Can you extract these pieces of like, what is the recommended light? What is the recommended, you know, soil conditions? Because those tend to take lots of people time going and finding out, but language models can extract that way faster than I would be able to.
Yeah. And I think this is like the prime use case for LLMs. Like extracting information from a lot of unstructured data, which you just wouldn't do with like human time, because no one wants to do it. And it's also just like infeasible the amount of time a human would like go through the documents to find that information.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming back to this, actually, you'd mentioned before to me report generation as being kind of like an untapped potential. You felt like, why do you think that is? Like, is there a lot of value you think in generating reports? Or
I stole at the moment a lot of the reasoning from like Jason Liu, who's like big in the LLM space as well. I had like a use case where we did like report generation stuff in 2021 already, where we implemented something which was just basically some data analysis plus automated reasoning on top of it. And I think we are getting to a place where the reasoning component of LLM is good enough that they can do a lot of analysis, which is usually considered human level. And in there for decision support. And I think when you're supporting decisions that are high stakes and high value, it's fine to spend a lot of money on compute and even an unreasonable amount of money on compute that you can take a lot of time, a lot of computations, take the most expensive model and have it go through all the documents you have on the topic. And to just generate like one report or key report on a decision you have to make. And this is probably something where LLMs are really uniquely suited for, because they are very good at processing a lot of information, a lot of unstructured information, condensing it, transforming it, and also just making a decision. And I think in a report, of course, you want it to be right. But often, if it's a high stakes decision, I think you could have like different LLMs generate multiple reports with multiple different perspectives just to get different points of view on a certain decisions. And they might even come up with stuff you haven't even considered. And I think when I'm making a decision, you can have the LLMs generate a lot of different like thesis decisions, like how to continue on the topic. And just having this thinking and the optionality and all the considerations it is doing is very valuable.
Yeah, no, I think that is super valuable. And I think that's one of the hard parts is like generating reports tend to be time consuming. But the biggest value is in what that report is actually telling you about your data. And that's where you're kind of saying like being able to generate multiple different reports and not have to do all the footwork to build each and every one of them. And, you know, I think this also I've seen as a interesting thing because a lot of times you'll generate these reports and they might be off. There might be some dimension that's off. And this is where, you know, there's still a need for skilled people reviewing it and saying, ah, it did the logic this way. I know that this needs to be tweaked. That is much easier for an expert to do than having to come up with the entire report definition by hand or by memory or however it may be.
Yeah, I think that two perspectives. First of all, like critique is always way easier.
Yeah.
And to see whether something is wrong. But also, many humans have preconceptions. LLMs have them as well. But if you give them the flexibility to actually generate multiple different versions from multiple different perspectives, they will likely come up with different solutions or different decisions. And like the human is likely coming up with one which is really biased. And I think just pointing out the different types of decisions or different options you might have has a lot of value.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. And also, like, I think this is one of the interesting bits that people are starting to get into. And I'm actually going to call out Elastic here, not for doing a good job themselves. But so Elastic, about a year ago, bought a company called Opster. And Opster had this really, I know this is so bad, but the way that I'm saying this is bad. But no, Elastic did a really good job by acquiring Opster because Opster had a piece of tech that was top tier. And it was their, what was it called? I forget the name specifically, but basically it was a, you know, automation layer on top of Elasticsearch for operational analysis. So it's been branded as AutoOps, and it was actually just released for Elastic Cloud users today. But the one thing that it does really well is it knows all of the different components that play into an application in Elasticsearch. It can read metadata from the different indexes. It can generate reports based off of that metadata. And it's this just really, really good workflow of, you know, being able to encapsulate a bunch of like domain expertise into an agent so that like not every single one of your users needs that domain expertise.
Yeah.
And no, go ahead.
Yeah, and what I really want to dive deeper in is using DSLs, so domain-specific languages, and creating a lot of training data, and basically train the LLM on it, and use that as basically the LLM who is doing the decision-making or analysis as well. And I think this has been shown in a few research papers that especially for example, for log analysis and error analysis in logs, it performs way better because it suddenly has a custom language, which is usually more restrictive to the domain. So the performance of the LLM is also better because it's restricted. And using that in like a broader sense for analysis and stuff like that is something I really want to explore because I think this will give even more of a boost to the models.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of this also comes down to, I think, some of the first iterations of this, from what I understand, it was mostly just prompt engineering. And it comes back to, like, they did a really good job up front with, you know, defining the problem, defining some of the tools, defining that workflow. And then they started stacking on top of it. And I actually don't know what state it's in now. I imagine they've gotten to the point where they're like, hey, we've fine-tuned. But again, because they have the experience, they have the expertise, they built up all of the things that they needed to be able to make that really, really successful. Yeah.
By the way, because we forgot it before, we only went into like one evaluation in
LLMs. Oh, yeah, yeah. Just all right, let's dive into another then.
For completeness, I think like the second one for me is the easiest, which is basically just using classifiers, which is like more the old school NLP. And so, for example, NLI models just for factuality classification. It's just a classic one you can do on top of models. And in general, like classifiers are a great tool because you can basically also classify the type of answers. God, for example, you can classify for safe for work, for example, as well. And yeah. I think like all the stuff you basically know also from search. And the second type is heuristics. And I think heuristics, it sounds a little bit more complicated, but it's really easy. You just do regex matches. And you basically score the output and you love, but it performs so well on like specific tasks. So for example, on a summary task, which is something where LLMs are used a lot, often models write, like when you tell it to write a summary, it starts like 80% of the time with like, this article ... talks about, or this email talks about ... And you can just use one score, which is basically a regex match on this article, and the summary basically is scored one, so it passes when it doesn't contain it, and zero when it's in there. And I think like if you combine like 10, 12 of these heuristics, you can get away with a lot of stuff. And when you combine that with LLMs as a church and with different classifiers, you have a pretty robust and well-functioning evaluation system. And the beauty of it is, especially the heuristics, you can use in real time, even when you're interacting with the users, because they are really fast. They're just string matches. And you basically can validate the output of the LLM, even in production. So it's not just used basically for evaluation during training or when you change a prompt or whatever, but you also can use it in production to basically validate the output. And if the output isn't valid, you basically can correct, you can regenerate, or you can just throw an error if it's a use case where you actually don't want to give the user invalid output.
Yeah, no, that's actually really, really interesting. And I've seen the classification case in a really interesting light, not recently, it was probably several months ago, but there was a company that I saw a white paper out of, and they were like, we basically had to start rethinking how we are building our system. They were basically trying to summarize large swaths of comments. So, you know, they had these comments on a product, and what they found was their language model that they had fine-tuned was producing all positive results. It was taking negative comments and it was producing positive comments or positive summarizations, disregarding completely the negative components. And they found, they were like, oh, well, that's what's, they used classification. They said, oh, our input is like 70% positive comments and 30% negative comments. And so, you know, like me being my naive self, I would think, oh yeah, so you just reduce the amount of positive comments that you have, and then you make it match, you know, and take your 70% positive, take it down to 30%. But you can't do that, it turns out, because what you lose is you lose actually information about the product. You lose things that were said. So what they did instead was they trained a model to turn positive comments into negative counterexamples. And then they were able to balance it such that the information wasn't lost, but the negatives had an equal amount of representation. And they were only able to do that because they had classified and figured out, like, hey, this is what is causing this problem, which I thought was, it was just a really interesting example that I saw.
Yeah. And I would expect the model they used probably was instruction fine-tuned, because we went into it earlier, that because they are trained to basically be harmless and be safe. So yeah, when you continue training on those and do your fine-tuning on this already instruction fine-tuned, you take the behavior with you.
Oh, man. Actually, that brings up a really good point. And this is one that me and several of my friends have been encountering a lot recently with instruction fine-tuned models, and they are afraid to tell people they're stupid. And I don't mean to say like people should actually be told that they're stupid, but I have asked several times for it to, I've asked them several times to do something that I knew was wrong. So for an example, I asked a language model to produce some code. I said, I want a bash one-liner that does this, and I want you to use this specific tool. And it went and produced an awful example that did not work because it was too afraid to tell me, no, bash has this really great built-in tool called, which one did it? Xargs, that's what it was. So I asked it to do it with awk, which was a terrible example, and it should have redirected me, said, hey, you can do exactly what you're doing with awk with Xargs in a much simpler way. And it's not going to tell people they're wrong. And that's a problem. That's actually, I feel like, going to be one of the biggest problems, because people are going to continue producing code, producing examples that are just bad, you know, because language models are afraid to tell us, like, you're doing this wrong.
Yeah, I need a model for coding as well. Like, you're just too stupid. You don't get it. Just tell me the reality.
Exactly. And that actually would be more helpful for me, you know, to know that, like, especially like for me, I'm learning Ruby right now, because for those who don't know, GitHub is a Ruby shop, and I am not a Ruby person. I am Python. I've done JavaScript. I'm like, Ruby is very, very different for me. And a lot of times I'll be like, hey, can you like create some code? And it creates some code and it uses kind of my example structure. And I'm like, okay, I actually have to ask it, how would a Ruby engineer do this? And it, I mean, the output that it produces completely different from the first output.
Yeah, I think that this, the Pythonic way or Go native, it's like all the lingo, you have to get it to write in a certain way.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I mean, like, maybe I'll throw this question to you. I gave a really terrible, vague example, but like, how could someone solve that problem where it's not producing enough like negative outputs? Can prompting do that?
It will be hard, because the closed source providers, you can train their models, which will remove some of the basically guardrails which are trained into the models, but at the same time they have additional guardrails in place, just for safety reasons, and they are probably classifiers. There are a lot of different stuff. They're probably also the reason why OpenAI hasn't released the advanced voice mode yet, because like guardrails for voice are way harder to do than for text, and it's hard. You can remove some of them, but it's really challenging, because they will have a lot of stuff running in the background which you don't really see. And it's probably in production one of the worst things is just like getting lots of errors when you want to return stuff to the customers, which can happen when you basically get classified as like something malicious or whatever.
Yeah.
If you have an open source model, it's very easy to remove them because you have access to basically the entire log props, so the probabilities of the different tokens that could have been predicted. So for the people who don't know it, a model usually doesn't predict a single token. It predicts basically a probability distribution. And you, when you have an open source model, you have access to this. And this makes it very easy to just remove the guardrails because you can see what token it predicts. Also, they are also already fine-tuning data sets to do it. If you use like non-instruction fine-tuned models, they have a lot less stuff just in there. So they are a lot more unhinged.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that's really interesting. I mean, that actually is one of the things I've been starting to experiment with. I actually just started using Open Web UI. I now host my own instance. And do you feel like a lot of people are going to start to, you know, host their own language models? Like, is that actually safer, or is that actually more valuable? Or do you think, I mean, the self-hosted language model user is just going to go by the wayside eventually?
I think it will be for the interested technical subsection of the world. And because I think LLMs will be integrated in a lot of different tools. They're being integrated in like the whole Office suite. They are already integrated in most of the code editors. Mm. And it's for people who don't really want to play around with it. I don't think they have a reason to do it. So I'm not sure whether it's like so many people will continue to do it. I think there is like a large population who just does it for the kicks of it and just enjoys it or wants to learn the stuff. And I think this will continue. But for the sake of like work, especially like coding, writing related, I think they will be integrated into the tool. So you will have no reason to host it on your own.
I see that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also, you can anticipate the ones that are integrated into your tool chains are probably better tuned for the type of work that you're doing than something you might host yourself.
I think if you want a different output, and I think like for me at the moment, especially in writing, when I'm writing my stuff, I don't like to use like the go-to LLMs because they produce the same stuff like everyone else gets from them. So for that, for example, you can actually like use custom models. I think they're way more valuable. So I have one fine-tuned for like writing based on pieces of writing I just like. And I basically just scraped writers I really enjoy, like their tweets, their LinkedIn posts, whatever. Just scraped it, trained a model on that, and now use it for basically writing stuff. And I think it produces way better results because it's like more personalized to what I want to write. And I think if you have reasons like that, yeah, that will be very valuable. But I think like, I'm not sure like how many people are interested in that because you can get to like 80% of the same stuff or like even 90% of the same stuff with regular LLMs. For me, it's just like the extra few percentage points you can get with doing this a lot of extra effort in the end.
Yeah. But I think that extra effort pays off, especially for you. Like you do this, you write a lot. So like, and I used to write a lot more. And that's one of the things I wished for was, you know, I kept getting like, I would, a lot of times I'd have like ideas of what I wanted to do for like talks. And, you know, when you're creating a talk, a large part of the work is generating the idea and then fitting it into the template that whatever conference provides, you know. So normally it's like title, description, you know, outline. But the problem that I kept running into was, like you mentioned, it became so obvious that the title was written by a language model, that the description was written by a language model. ChatGPT is terrible about this because almost every single title it produces is like, 2 to 3 words, colon, some other subtitle. And it's just, it frustrates me so much. And like, even the wording in the document is, I'm like, this is not the wording that I would use. So that's one of the things I'm starting to look at. And I think it's going to get easier hardware wise too. There are a lot of companies that I've seen in the space, like Zima or Ice Whale has produced a thing called the Zima Cube, which is supposedly like, it's like a GPU, it's a motherboard, and then some disk drives, which again, they're like, hey, look, you can run language models locally. The company that used to produce the Compute Blades, or actually, I shouldn't say used to produce, they're still producing Compute Blades, but now they've got an AI thing, and everybody's starting to build AI hardware, which I think is going to be really good in the one sense, because it's going to make it accessible, but it's also really bad in another sense, because I feel like a lot of companies that have really interesting technologies are just getting hold in making AI, AI hardware, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah. I think part of the reason I didn't go Linux with the current desktop I'm using, it's like because the Apple hardware and all the infrastructure in LLMs is so good for Apple, because most of the libraries for like local inference are built for Apple.
Interesting.
Because it's like such a large majority of developers using MacBooks, and that's where the space got started. And that's why it's really optimized for Apple devices.
It's funny you say that, because I specifically went and built a Linux desktop with an NVIDIA GPU. But for me, it was for a very specific reason, because I was working on a problem where I was trying to do, what is that called? Quantization. And I couldn't fit the models in memory on the laptop that I had at the time. And that was a huge problem for me. That also is not the type of work most people are doing on their MacBooks. Like you said, it's the local inference is getting really, really good on Apple devices, which I appreciate.
Yeah. I went with an M2 Ultra. So it's like, I splunged a little bit with a really beefy machine to really go big with the models as well.
Yeah, because it's handy. I mean, I do think you get better output out of those larger models. But I want to say thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us all of this expertise. I feel like I'm going to have to sit and rewatch this episode probably a dozen times to feel like I really understood everything we've talked about. But also, I want to call out Nikolai also has his own podcast, How AI is Built, which I'm going to be featured on here in a couple of weeks. Or what is the timeline, actually? Do you know?
When will you publish this episode? Then I can tailor the date.
Okay, because I am probably... So this is a funny thing. For not a lot of people know, but I am a very scrappy podcaster. So I will probably have this published by the following Monday.
Okay, probably like the week after that.
There we go. There we go. Deal. You should absolutely go check out his podcast, How AI is Built. Right now he's going into the search specialization and how that impacts AI. You have these wonderful, well-planned seasons, which I aspire to do one day. And also, you do consulting with your company, Icebox Data Solutions, yeah?
Yeah. So we're doing consulting. In the end, we're doing implementations. So if you have technical issues, where you would like an external people to have a look at it or have a crack at it, we really like to do that. We especially really like to bring a company into the AI age, so really take a long time and work with them, start with the first AI implementations, and also train their internal staff and internal AI teams until we at some point can hand over all of our work and basically fire ourselves. This is basically our dream scenario in the end. We work a lot, like all generative AI stuff, like VLLMs, LLMs, but also like my co-founder is from the bioinformatics space. So a lot in biomedical as well. My other co-founder is from the financial space. So in finance with like the time series model, which is my expertise. So if you want me, you would have to stick with LLMs, VLMs or generative AI. Otherwise, I'm also happy to hand you over to my co-founders.
No, that's awesome. And also, it's so nice to hear that you just don't like dump data solutions on people and then run away and leave them unsupported. That's so unconsultant-like of you. No, that's awesome. Well, thank you all for watching. Thank you, Nikolai, for coming on the show. And we will see you next time on For the Sake of Search. Ciao.